responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss the latest on sequestration with Congressman John Sarbanes and progressive budget proposals with Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey. And later, we'll learn more about AFGE's collective bargaining agreement with the Transportation Security Administration with Local 556 President Don Thomas. But first, we've been joined by First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Bob, as we make our way through sequestration and federal employees facing mandatory furloughs, First Command has created a checklist of sorts of common sense ideas to help them deal with the cuts. Before we get into the specifics of the checklist, talk to me a little bit about why you created it.
Well, Jason, I think that federal employees are very familiar with the effects of having their pay frozen for the last 2 years. And, of course, it looks like 2013 is going to be a repeat of that with another pay freeze. And they have been able to adapt to those changes and the fact that their pay hasn't increased over that period of time. But, Jason, we really are entering uncharted waters now because federal employees have not faced furloughs that were based on the sequestration. Many of your listeners remember the government shutdown in 1998. And 96. And during that 28-day period of time when the government was shut down, they were furloughed. But after the shutdown ended, Congress decided to pay them for the days that they lost. We don't know that that's going to happen this time. So it really does put an extra emphasis on the need for federal employees to prepare. And, you know, we're all familiar with the Boy Scout motto of be prepared. And I strongly recommend that all federal employees listen to that motto, heed it, and start getting prepared.
One of the things that you point out on your list is separating needs from wants, which may seem easy, but oftentimes the two can blend together. Talk to me about the differences between a need and a want.
When we sit down with prospective clients or clients, we always look at their monthly budget. And some individuals do a great job of developing spreadsheets that can track every expenditure that they have. And other individuals just don't know where their money goes. So if you're not interested in developing a formal budget, I would ask you to think about the next expenditure you're going to have and to separate the needs from the wants. For example, a need includes things like your mortgage or rent, paying your utilities, putting food on the table, and making sure your insurance premiums are paid. Wants are something else. So this weekend, for example, you have some free time and you want to go to the mall. You just have to ask yourself, do I need to buy that item? Do I really need to go see the first run movie Saturday evening? Do I need that afternoon jolt of caffeine at Starbucks? Those are all the wants that, if we think about it, really do add up in terms of how much money every month goes to those types of items.
And when people are looking at their budgets or their balance sheets and they're able to identify some of these things, would you be recommending them taking a look at some of those fixed expenses, like you said, making sure that things like the mortgage is paid for, any of your health care costs, things like that?
Certainly. They have to keep that in front of them to understand how much they really are spending on a monthly basis and to think about alternatives to those. At the same time, Jason, we recommend that individuals use some of that money that is currently being spent on wants and to redirect that money into emergency savings or a rainy day fund.
Speaking of savings or a rainy day fund, that's something that certainly needs to be considered. Talk about why that's so critical given this situation where many federal employees are looking at a 20% reduction in pay and some of the Border Patrol agents looking at as much as a 35% reduction in their paychecks.
Many Americans currently aren't able to go beyond paycheck to paycheck. They just don't have any emergency savings. So I'm sure that applies to many federal employees. So just think about a 20 to 30% cut in your pay over the next 6 months. It can be very dramatic and have a devastating impact on individuals in their lives. So putting money aside into a rainy day fund, even if the sequestration isn't as severe as we think it might be, will allow you then to have money there for the requirements that you have, such as making sure that you pay your rent or mortgage, that you do have food on the table, that you're able to meet those requirements. And then I would ask federal employees to think about how much money is that on a monthly basis that goes for those requirements. Put that, make every effort to have at least that much in savings. And then once you have that, put additional dollars into savings, even if it's for a short period of time. If it turns out that you didn't need those dollars, there's always ways that they can be redirected or spent.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, as you know, tax day is coming up quickly. What advice would you give to someone who's working on that, getting their taxes filed and taken care of?
So many of us really dread the idea of completing a tax return. I would just say, if you think you're going to get an income tax return, file your taxes as soon as possible. Get your money then as soon as possible. If you think you're going to owe Uncle Sam some money, delay filing your taxes until April 15th. Very common sense way of just either getting money sooner or paying money later.
Like many Americans, Bob, some federal employees out there may have some credit card debt. How would you recommend they handle the debt while also trying to bolster their savings a bit in mm-hmm. anticipation of the furloughs?
Well, according to the government, the average household credit card debt currently, Jason, is $15,000. So many people are paying 18, 19, 20% or more interest on those credit cards. I would recommend that they call their bank and try to negotiate a lower interest rate. Some banks will actually do it, others won't. If your bank won't, then I recommend you call other banks and to talk with them about possibly gaining a lower interest rate on your credit card and doing what's called a balance transfer, which means that the balance of your credit card would go to another credit card that has a lower interest rate. It really can save you significant dollars on a monthly basis just on the interest, but of course, hand in glove with that, we want you to start paying down debt so that you are in a position where you really are now using the money for what's important to you as opposed to paying the bank interest.
Before we continue on with the checklist, Bob, talk to me about a situation or two with a client that you've dealt with who is looking at a potential furlough. How have you handled that situation?
We've had individuals come in and because of their situation, are almost ready to hit the panic button. And they really are not, should not do that. I think, again, these common sense steps will help them to really gain more confidence in their financial situation. We've had individuals, Jason, tell us that if they have to, they're going to cancel their federal employee group life insurance or their federal employee health benefits. That's the last thing you want to do because we have insurance for all of the what-ifs of life. So making sure that you continue your premium payments, whether that's for rent or mortgage, health, life, those are very important, and those would be the last things that you want to touch.
One of the things that you mention on the checklist is continuing to contribute to your thrift savings plan, about 5%, I believe you say. Talk to me about why you would recommend doing that in a time like this.
This sequestration and the furloughs that federal employees are facing really are a short-term situation, a short-term problem. We still have to think long-term, and all of us are going to need as much money in retirement as we can possibly put together. So the power of thrift savings plan, as you well know, Jason, is that because FERS employees get up to 5% of their salary matched every pay period, they're getting free money from the government for investing. So we would recommend that if a federal employee does need to reduce their TSP contribution, that they not go below the 5% threshold because they will be giving up some of the free money that the government is giving them as their employer. When they get to a point where they're more confident about their financial situation and now they're not furloughed, they can make another decision as to how much they'll contribute and catch up to where they were before in their total contributions for the year.
Last, Bob, but certainly not least, it's important to know where you stand. And by that, you mean looking at your credit report to make sure that everything is in order before being furloughed. Tell me about this.
I think this is a great time for us to take stock of our financial situations. And one of the things that federal employees may not be doing right now are thinking about long-term purchases such as buying a house, getting a mortgage. But as you know, those decisions are based on your credit report. So I recommend that federal employees, and all people for that matter, go to the Federal Trade Commission website, www.federaltradecommission.com, .gov, and use the annual credit report that's available to them. And they can get reports from all three of the credit reporting agencies in the United States to see if, in fact, all the information that is there is accurate. They may be surprised that they have something on that record that is incorrect, and they can get it corrected, which may affect their overall credit score.
Is there a cost associated with getting that report?
It's a great question. This annual credit report is the free report that's available. There are other companies that talk about free credit reports, but it's the annual credit report through the Federal Trade Commission that is available to all Americans at no cost.
Bob, do you think this entire situation presents an opportunity for learning down the road, almost giving people, through necessity, the opportunity to hit the reset button on their finances and take a look at how much they're spending versus how much they're bringing in?
I really think that this is a wake-up call for a lot of folks, Jason, and I think it's an opportunity to turn lemons into lemonade. And I mean that by just going through these common sense steps that anyone can take to look at their expenditures on a monthly basis, comparing needs and wants, paying yourself first by building up your savings and adjusting your withholdings and paying down debt over time will make very large and significant improvements to your overall financial situation. So again, at a time when there's a lot of concern, and I appreciate the concern that individuals have, the fact that they really are going to have a pay cut for a period of time, this is the time for action. This is a time for us to all look at our financial situation and our financial futures, because we've got a lot of years ahead of us.
Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for coming by to see me today.
My pleasure, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the latest on sequestration with Congressman John Sarbanes.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand-name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Congressman John Sarbanes from Maryland. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Sequestration has taken effect, and federal employees will soon be faced with mandatory furloughs. Congressman, what is your reaction to all of this?
Well, I agree that news is, you know, it's fundamentally unfair to the federal worker. And by the way, let me just say at the outset, I want to salute AFGE for being such a strong advocate for the interests of those who are in our federal workplace. But, you know, the federal workers have already contributed substantially to deficit reduction. I mean, we can go back over the numbers, but you look at, in terms of these pay freezes and other things that have been in place over the last couple of years, you know, federal workers can say with a straight face, we've already contributed more than $100 billion to try to achieve deficit reduction. And yet here you come with sequestration, which is basically cuts coming onto the federal worker again. So I think it's fundamentally unfair, particularly when there's other ways that we can address these deficit issues that we have. There's plenty of revenue options that ought to be considered. Democrats have put those forward, but unfortunately they're not getting much of an audience with this House Republican majority.
Congressman, can you talk a little bit about some of those other ways to address deficit reduction?
Sure. Well, for starters, there are tax subsidies, taxpayer subsidies that continue to flow out to industries that don't need them anymore. And probably Exhibit A in this is the oil and gas industry. If you look at the year 2011, the big five oil companies, that's BP, Exxon, Shell, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips, among them made $137 billion, that's billion, in profits. And yet they continue to receive about $5 billion in federal subsidies and support each year. So how do you go to federal workers and ask them to take another hit to their budget, which, by the way, has a ripple effect in terms of the service to the public, which I think is a critical point to make. How do you go to them and say, you got to give more? You've already given $100 billion. We're going to cut you even more, cut your ability to provide quality service to the public, but we're going to keep sending $5 billion a year to an oil and gas industry that's posting hundreds of billions of dollars in profits. So there's an example of where you can find savings somewhere else in the federal budget and don't have to turn to the federal worker to always be the solution. There's loopholes. There's Wall Street loopholes that could be closed. You know, these hedge fund managers on Wall Street are not paying, in terms of a tax, what they ought to be paying. You could close that loophole. You could put a Wall Street transaction in place, which would be very modest in terms of its impact on the Wall Street crowd, but could generate significant revenue, which means you don't have to go find as many cuts, again, from all different places, but certainly from the federal worker.
Congressman, as you had mentioned in the outset, federal employees have contributed more than $100 billion to deficit reduction, looking at now a three-year pay freeze. And then on top of that, of course, furloughs, many of whom will be looking at about a 20% reduction in pay. And if you look at the Border Patrol, perhaps even more, up to 30% of a reduction in their paychecks. What are your constituents in Maryland in the 3rd District there saying about all of this?
Well, I think you have two perspectives. One is that it just places a heavy burden on these families that are going to be directly affected, you know, federal workers and their families, because, as you point out, a furlough translates into reduced income over a period of time, and it's an unfair burden to place. But those are families are going to have to figure out, you know, how to deal with that lost income. But another perspective is, when you impose this hit on certain agencies, you know, you look at a state like Maryland. We have 130,000 federal employees, and they're deployed across dozens of military installations and then non-military federal installations. The impact, for example, on Fort Meade, on the National Security Agency, on BWI, Thurgood Marshall Airport. When you have to contract the services at locations like that, it has a ripple effect in the surrounding community. Let's think about the airport for a minute. If you're having to cut back on flights potentially because you're having to constrain what the air traffic controller's capacity is going to be as a result of these cuts, well, that means potentially less passenger traffic. Over time, that affects vendors in the airport. It then affects suppliers outside the airport. Before you know it, you've got this cascading effect as a result of the cuts that affect BWI. You look at Fort Meade, NSA, that whole area. Again, if you're pulling back, contracting the economy of those large economic assets in Maryland, it's having a ripple effect on the communities of vendors and contractors that depend on it. So it's both the immediate impact that it has on a federal worker and their family, but also the indirect cascading effect that it has on a lot of other people in the equation.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Congressman John Sarbanes representing Maryland's 3rd District. Congressman, you went through there and detailed a couple of real scenarios of the impact of some of these cuts. My question for you is, if a budget gets resolved, if the furloughs get resolved at some point, are there still lasting long-term effects of what these cuts would mean at those areas that you discussed?
We had testimony in a hearing we held a couple weeks back, just before the sequestration took effect. And one of the consistent themes of all the witnesses was that when you do these slowdowns, when you kind of take a pause in the operations of agencies because of them having to handle the sequestration. There's a cost in catching up afterwards. And that's going to be the case in every agency that's affected. So that's why it's such a senseless way of doing budgeting, because you have this kind of arbitrary cuts that go across the board. They're not thought through. Therefore, they're not efficient. And then having to catch up after you've put that cut in place imposes other costs on the system. So you're hitting yourself twice. And that's going to happen because we're now into sequestration. So you point out, well, maybe there will be a deal at some point, you know, and we'll substitute for the current way we're doing things, and we'll avoid some of the future cuts that are being projected. But you've still got to deal with the effects of having put this slowdown in, you know, that began 2 weeks ago now. So it's really a senseless way of approaching this. There's a great analogy people are using, which is if you had a household budget and you had a budget for pizza and entertainment, and you had a budget for basic food that you needed to go buy, and you had to find savings in your budget, you wouldn't just put like an 8% cut across your whole budget and reduce your pizza budget by 8% and your basic food budget by 8%. You'd say, wait a second, you know, we won't go out for pizza and do entertainment for a little while because we want to keep this other part of our budget in place. But the way sequestration works, you got to do it across the board. It doesn't make any sense at all. And as we've said, it has a very unfair impact on the federal worker.
Congressman, as you're up on the Hill every day working, what's the mood there? What's the conversation like with your colleagues?
I think there's a lot of frustration about how we're sort of conducting business here. We kind of go from one budget crisis to the next. What I worry about the most, Jason, is, you know, people say, well, you're not really getting anything done up there. And I say, well, I take that point, but even worse than that, we're getting used to not getting anything done. In other words, a mentality can begin to creep into the way you conduct your affairs here, where you leave town without having a transportation bill, or you leave town without reauthorizing the FAA, for example. And people start to get used to that. Before you know it, you're running your government like a third world country. That's not sensible. It's not fair to hardworking federal employees who get up every day and try to serve the public. And, you know, when I go around my district and I talk to constituents, they're very appreciative of the services that they receive from these federal agencies and the hard work that federal workers put in every single day. And, you know, there's a narrative that gets put out there of the sort of federal worker as a kind of bureaucrat. I don't find that. I find people that are very dedicated to the job. And when we hurt them, we hurt the broader public. And frankly, we hurt the strength of the country, which needs a nimble, strong, well-resourced, and well-respected federal government in order to operate effectively.
As we close out here, Congressman, what ultimately do you think the end result will be in this situation?
Well, I think what's going to happen is the effects of this sequestration are going to become more visible to the public. You know, sometimes it's hard to connect the dots on this, and that will increase the perception and feeling in the country that this is not the way to address our deficit, just by imposing these kind of random, arbitrary, wholesale cuts. And as that sentiment heightens, I think it will create more pressure on some of the members here that for the moment seem very content to head down a path that says, you know, government doesn't really matter and we can do without it. And maybe they'll start feeling the pressure in their offices from their constituents. They'll start to realize, hey, I got constituents that are calling who need help with Social Security, or they have a veterans benefit issue, and how can I help them? On the one hand, if I'm turning around and voting for cuts to those agencies, on the other. So I think that's going to start, those chickens are going to start coming home to roost. That'll create more pressure. And we'll be able to get a kind of different solution put in place. But as you noted very rightly, we will have imposed unnecessary costs and burdens on ourselves in the meantime, and that's really no way to conduct business.
Congressman John Sarbanes, representing Maryland's 3rd District. Congressman, always fun to have you on the program. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks very much, Jason. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about progressive budget proposals with Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, SeaWorld, and Universal Studios? And if you enjoy winter activities, take advantage of discount lift tickets for New England ski resorts. These are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. AFGE also offers members a host of other valuable benefits, from scholarships and insurance to discounts on computers, appliances, health clubs, and more. AFGE is the largest and most influential federal and D.C. government employee union in the United States. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Go to AFGE.org and click on the Join AFGE Today button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, welcome back.
Thank you, Jason. Good to be with you and your listeners.
Roger, the Campaign for America's Future has put its support behind the Congressional Progressive Caucus's Back to Work budget, which is in stark contrast to Congressman Ryan's Path to Prosperity proposal in the House. Tell me about the Back to Work budget.
Well, it's important to realize that Paul Ryan and his Republican budget are really trying to keep America fixated on debt and deficits when most Americans care most about jobs, economic growth, the future of their family, whether they can keep their job or not. And so the Republicans are not only changing the subject, but they're damaging the economy by these drastic cuts, these layoffs in government employees. The Ryan budget is more of the same austerity that has really destroyed the European economies. And the Congressional Progressive Caucus budget is the one budget that actually talks about creating jobs. It talks about investing in 7 million new jobs over the next year, getting the economy moving, getting people paying as taxpayers instead of receiving unemployment checks, and therefore does a lot to reduce the deficit, because when people are taxpayers, when people are working, that's when we bring down the deficit, as we have during this economic recovery. The Congressional Progressive Caucus really needs to be praised for talking about a budget that would actually improve the health of the U.S. economy.
Roger, so you're saying jobs first and then address the debt and the deficit later.
Yes, and when you press conservatives, they will agree with that, that as long as the economy is shrinking, or if it's given a body blow again with a strong dose of austerity right now, the deficits are actually going to go up. It's conservatives, as I say, will agree with that. But in fact, almost all conservatives are calling for more austerity, more cuts, more layoffs, more taking stimulus out of the economy instead of putting people back to work, getting people employed. And that's the point at which you can start worrying about cutting programs if you're or healthcare reform long term, once you've got the economy up and running. So we have here a debate, which I think is going to go on until the midterm elections in 2014. We want to have a debate between Democrats who believe in growth and prosperity versus Republicans who are actively sabotaging that economic recovery and are the equivalent of the European conservatives who are causing recession all over the world right now.
Roger, earlier you mentioned that this plan, part of it calls for investing in about 7 million new jobs within the next year. What would that mean for the unemployment rate in this country?
Well, that would put us within striking distance of what we think of as full employment. It would also stimulate a lot of local jobs in every community in the country. Because when people are working, they start spending their money in local shops and local services. So what we're aiming at is close to full employment, 5% unemployment. Now we've got a lot to do because we haven't been keeping up with new entrants into the labor market. Young people coming out of high school can tell you that. They're not finding good jobs, and we need to provide good jobs for those kids. But it's also, we're not yet growing at a pace where we're absorbing the people who were laid off during the Great Recession. We need to do both. And this budget from the Congressional Progressive Caucus would do a lot toward getting us back on a path where just about anybody that has a job or needs a job can find one. The alternative is another decade of kind of permanent levels of unemployment at 7% and 8%, and all the discouragement to people outside the workforce. More austerity, which means more layoffs in government at every level, from the federal government to state level and local teachers and firemen. We need to absorb those people who were laid off and start employing the new entrants to the workforce. And this is the scale of job creation that would allow us to start doing that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, as you know, federal employees are faced with mandatory furloughs as part of the sequester, which has now kicked in. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and this is one of a string of indignities that federal workers have had to deal with. Pay freezes and other changes in different agencies as we've ratcheted down this austerity. The sequestration was supposed to be so bad. These automatic cuts were supposed to be so bad that nobody would let them happen. But it turns out that corporate America and the Defense Department, who are going to be hurt badly by these sequestration cuts, are overruled by the Tea Party in the Congress, who are only too happy to let these cuts and layoffs continue. It's not clear when there's going to be a deal to lift sequestration, and that's why we join with the AFL-CIO and others to tell Congress, let's get rid of the sequestration. It was created in response to the Republican threat to not lift our debt limit and to throw the whole world economy into chaos. That was a powerful threat. It led to this sequestration. The point is that was a congressionally created crisis, sequestration, and if Congress can create it, Congress can end it right now. So that's one of the messages that we ought to be saying to Congress. If you can't make a good deal, let's just back out of sequestration and at least get back to a government that has enough resources and people to do basic services.
Roger, do you think that average middle-class Americans understand the impact that the sequester will have on public services, many that they rely on?
Well, it turns out that it's going to be a slow realization as people go to national parks and discover that they're closed or greatly reduced services, as people realize that people, folks at the Social Security are backlogged because there's people on furlough and they can't get their questions answered or their forms filled. It's going to be a dawning realization, and I just hope that the Democrats keep laying the blame for this this sequestration on the Republicans, keep reminding voters that it was the Republicans who were refusing to lift sequestration, and eventually it's going to it's also going to cut into economic growth. The estimates from the CBO are 700,000, maybe a million jobs that are going to be lost due to the slowdown in the economy that this is going to cause. So it's very, very important that we remind people that this is having a, it's like a slow heart attack. It's like an erosion of the U.S. economy, and we've got to remind people that that the conservatives in the Congress are imposing this upon all of us.
Roger, as we close out here, aside from job creation, what else needs to happen for America to get its fiscal house in order?
Well, the we actually, it's important for people to know, we actually have stabilized the deficit, which went up during the recession. They always do. And now we've stabilized the deficit as a percentage of the now slowly growing GDP. Yes, over the long term, we have a problem with health care costs in the United States, and that, of course, drives Medicare prices up as well. If we got health care as efficient in the United States, I mean, private health care system as efficient as they have in many European countries, we would not have a problem with Medicare. Medicare would be stabilized. They wouldn't be paying these outrageous prices for hospitals and drugs, and we would have no long-term budget deficit at all. So we need to stop the austerity in the short term so we can put more people to work. And in the longer term, what we need is more serious reform of our healthcare system. If we do that and keep the economy growing, we have no real long-term problem.
Roger Hickey, the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, always great having you on the show. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Jesse.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn more about AFGE's collective bargaining agreement with the Transportation Security Administration with Local 556 President Don Thomas.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program. It offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program's administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office. It's handled more than 700 cases since 2005 and won millions of dollars in back pay for its members. In each of the last 2 years alone, AFGE attorneys have brought in more than $1 million in attorney's fees. Their attorneys are experienced litigators and committed to the best possible representation. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit Systems Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For more information about the program, please call 202-639-6424. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Don Thomas, the president of AFGE's Local 556 in Orlando. Don, welcome back to the program.
Hey, always a pleasure, my friend.
Don, what's happening at TSA these days? Give me an update.
Oh, man, where do I begin? As you know, we have the contract in place and running. We have issues going on and trying to get the contract implemented. In 556, we decided to train many stewards as we can. You know, we're training a lot of stewards up and down the state. So our local goes from Pepsi-Cola, Florida, all the way down to Sarasota, which covers half the state of Florida. So we're training stewards in all those airports, Tallahassee, Gainesville, Jacksonville, Daytona. So our plan is to train many stewards as we can to create an army, as you will.
What do you think the ultimate impact would be of that effort, training stewards?
I think the more stewards you have, management knows that we're kind of serious, that there are people on the floor that are knowledgeable of the CBA contract. And more people have knowledge of the CBA contract, the better for the workers. And the workers have someplace to go talk to people about it. One thing that we are going to be doing with the stewards, we're putting in each airport once a month training or a stop by a workshop in each airport once a month to have a place where the TSOs can come by and talk about the CBA that's in their issue or handling the part that they need to talk to us about. And also for management to actually see that we can actually work together on stuff to issue before they go to arbitration. Nobody wants arbitration. And we're trying to avoid that by giving everybody knowledge of the CBA. Once they get finished with the CBA and get a book in their hand, they can meet with management, they can meet with us, and get their issue resolved before it gets out of hand. We know we have knuckleheads, but, you know, that's going to happen.
Now that the contract has been finalized, that it's being implemented, are you finding more people wanting to participate in the way of being a steward and learn more about it and help their fellow members?
It's actually pretty interesting because when you say that, I thought it'd be like a big rush of people, but some people are still being standoff. They're trying to make sure it works and trying to find out what is a CBA contract because most people in Florida have no idea. They came up with unions is a bad thing and blah, 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 and unions were this and that. So we run into that issue. A lot of people that's been around are the younger people that think unions are bad. So we're trying to educate them that the union is good for you. And some of the managers that actually came up with that union were bad too, and they realized, the unions are here to help you, too, not just the workers. It makes your job a lot easier.
Certainly a challenging environment for you if you're working in a capacity where people might think that the union is detrimental to them or whatnot. But talk to me about some of the things that are in the contract that dispel those myths about the union.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that mostly in our job at TSA, TSA is very stressful. So a lot of people get sick and get tired. They might need a day off or two. They might need time off just to relax. TSA had this policy. If you go home one day, they wanted a doctor's note after one day. So they wanted you to be home sick, go up, go to a doctor and get a doctor's note, spend $35 to $80 on a copay, get out of bed for one day and get a doctor's note and come back each day you're out. One thing in the contract, it implemented the three-day doctor's note rule. Then after 3 days, you can self-certify yourself as being sick. So a lot of people are doing right now. So now instead of just in the beginning, they were taking off one day. They said, well, they took off one day and I'm feeling well. They were taking off 3 days instead of they only need like one day to take off. But they were taking off three because they were forced to, with the doctor's note, taking 3 days off and leaving the workforce short. So as we find out right now that people got that leeway, they're taking that 1 or 2 days off or when they're sick, they're doing that instead of the 3 days. So attendance are starting to rise. So it helps out management and helps out the work at the same time. Because if you've been around in Orlando and Florida this month or the past couple of months, it's been really busy. For example, Christmas time and Thanksgiving time, 80, 90,000 people a day coming through there taxed us. And then we have the flu going on and taxed a lot of people. So you need that 1 or 2 days off without going to the doctor or you might get sick, something like that. So that issue was very, very vital for us in the workforce.
And despite the workload and the flu that was going around, demand is still there for you all to come and show up and keep the flying public safe.
Yes, exactly. It's there. We're working tirelessly. We have people working overtime and people being sick coming in. I was sick myself, but I kept getting out of bed trying to, and it lasted longer than I wanted to. But we needed that presence on the floor because it's the holiday season and people are counting on us to get the people safe. I want to take in mind all those 80, 90,000 people a day, every day, every day, not one incident happened. And that's because of the federal workforce that we have, the professionalism that we have over the years that we learned. For example, I've been there 10 years. I've mastered my craft a little bit. It took me 10 years to kind of master my craft of allowing people to come in and knowing what's on the screen, what's not on the screen, what's prohibited, what's not prohibited. It's taken years for us to learn. This is why it's full and vital that we stay with the federal program instead of bringing a private company and starting all over again. With people who are not familiar with what goes on with the policies and what goes on with the issues and what goes on with their X-ray and all the stuff that goes on with being there for 10 years. Bringing a private company in, we know we got a lot of proud people working there and a lot of retirees, and they'll just say, hey, look, I was here because this is the part of the job I want. I'm not going to work here under the stressful hand of somebody can fire me because I looked the wrong way. Being a federal program, you know, you have a chance to find what happened before you get fired or before you get your job or lose. And that's what having a union does for you. With a private company, that's out the window, and people will be gone.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're here with Don Thomas, the president of AFGE's TSA Local 556 in Orlando. Don, some opponents of collective bargaining rights say that it hurts national security, that it's not good for the country. Clearly, there's a divide there, and you disagree. Tell me why the collective bargaining agreement that you have in place now that AFGE fought for improves national security.
Like I said earlier, it improves the mental part of people coming in, like getting that day's rest or getting that time off when you need it or not feeling stressful out. Knowing that some of the things are taken care of, that you don't have to worry about the $80, $90 you're going to spend, the doctor's time, and the extra time you need off. For example, knowing when a manager just can't come after you anymore, that there's a process for him to write you up or give you a disciplinary action, that you have somebody on your side that can take care of that now. I don't have to worry about managers being over-aggressive with me when something goes down. I have a voice now with the managers. So long in TSA, they had a blank check writing the blank checks for so many years. Now with a CBA contract, you got to have two signatures on that check now, and you got to ask why you're writing that check instead of just imposing it on the workers. So the workers have some kind of voice. If you give a worker some kind of voice, they'll work a little bit better for you. They'll work a little bit harder. They'll work a little bit more. But when you're beating them down, so-and-so, they start saying, why should I work hard? Because you're going to beat me down. So a CBA contract is not just for the workers, but it improves the morale of the workers, period.
Don, one of the things that you mentioned earlier is that you've been at this for quite a while, at least a decade, working at TSA, and it's something that you have a lot of institutional knowledge. Now, that's something that is important in your job function, I imagine, and TSA had seen a lot of turnover because of the working conditions. Do you think that with the collective bargaining agreement in place, the rate of turnover will decrease, thereby making the agency more secure?
Yes. I mean, yeah, that. In the past, the turnover was horrible, you know, and most agencies that does have a collective bargaining unit, their turnovers are in the single digits. TSA has been in the double digits for years and years and years because of one of the reasons not having a CBA contract, not allowing that worker to have that voice or have that that backup that they need to make their job a little bit better for them. There's small things that we're going to be working out. There's one big other issue that we have with the women in TSA. We're losing a lot of women in TSA. Of issues of being overworked, being mothers. They have no place to go for, like, breastfeeding. They had no room. They had no place to go. So they're, even our CBA contract, now we have to have a room for them to go breastfeed and like that. And that is huge for women to see that happening. And it gives them, like, oh, there is something for us. There is something for women to, you have fair practice women's coordinators that women can go and talk to issues about their own issues. One thing we're starting in Orlando, we're starting the women's only town hall meetings and women's only meetings where they can bring up issues because they're on the floor, attractive women like guys come in the line, you know, young guys are probably like hitting on them, older guys and stuff like that. And they got all the issues they got to deal with and trying to keep the people safe. Why can't we, with a CBA contract, take some of that pressure off them? The kids, the breastfeeding part, have a place where they can talk about the issues of being a woman on TSA and things like that.
Are you finding that management is receptive to these concerns that you bring up to them?
Yeah, man. Some of my airports are online. Like I have some great relationships with some of the managers and some of the TSOs. Prior to the contract, we had the insight to go to work with the managers and work with the FSDs prior to the contract, let them know what we're going to be doing, how can we work together. So quite a few of my airports are coming online. When we get there to train people, they say, you guys need a room. What can we do for you? You guys need these guys off. They get them off the floor. So they're being very helpful in some of the airports. But there's always one or two airports that doesn't want to cooperate because the bigger airports got more people. The more people you got, the more people are going to be against it. So
earlier we touched a little bit on privatization efforts throughout TSA. Your airport in Orlando is under the same threat. Talk to me about the latest.
Yes, we're under the threat of MCO, Orlando International Airport. Our sister airport, Sanford, has already applied for a private, being private. They've been accepted. They are looking at getting a company in to take over. But one thing about Sanford is a smaller airport, so the writing was kind of on the wall because it is Micah's territory, and he's been lobbying for years to get that for a long time. So one thing about MCO in Orlando, what we're trying to do, we're trying to do what they did in Sacramento. Sacramento was going headed that way, and they overturned it by having the union involved, having people go to their congressmen, petition. So we're trying to do the same thing in Orlando. Orlando haven't applied, but they're looking at it by using the customer service report. They want to use a customer service report against TSA to get the board to vote, let's go private. So we're trying to be up here in Washington to talk to the senators and talk to everybody. Let's stop this because it'll be very, very dangerous for that size airport to go private. Orlando recently just had one of the private companies that was subcontracted at another private company. They had no license, and it was discovered recently that they had no license to be in the airport. So they got booted out, the company, and the company that took them under, who Covenant, who was lobbying for privatization, was fined $25,000 for allowing that company not to be in without a license. We say, I've been saying this for a long time, a private company, for example, they would not put safety ahead. Being federalized, for example, if we had a machine that was malfunctioning and 20 people got through without the machine functioning, we wouldn't hesitate to go down and shut the whole airside down and bring them over. Now, my question is, with a private company that has money involved, will they do the same thing? Because it costs a lot of money to shut an airside down. Will that private company spend that $15, $20 million to make sure everybody's safe, or will they just put the plug back in and say, let everybody go through? That's a big question mark, and I haven't heard anybody would say anything differently, because the private company is about profit. The federalized is about safety. TSA is about safety and federalizing. That's the main concern of TSA. That's the big difference between private and going and having federalized.
And, of course, you are here this week for AFGE's Legislative and Grassroots Mobilization Conference, taking your issues to Capitol Hill to present your case. How do legislators respond to some of the things that you just mentioned about the public versus private initiatives at TSA?
Yeah, when you talk about it, when you put it down to like where they can touch it and feel it, their eyebrows go up, because no one's always talking about the big money, but no one's talking about the safety issue, like what's going to happen to me, what's going to happen to you if this happens goes through. What's the safety part of it? That we're here to make it safe. Even down to your personal items that that people do are watching out for. We have a policy in TSA, and I'm a strong opponent of it. There's been, over the 10 years, about 300 people. Over 10 years, over 180,000 people coming through the airport or working in TSA. 300 people have been fired for theft. That's less than 0.9% than the national average. National average are 3 or 4 people stealing on the front. So TSA has a great record, and that's because we're federalized. We have a background check program. It's not 100%, but it's the best deterrent that we got to see weed people out. Eventually, you will get caught doing something wrong in there. So these are the type of things that we say when we talk to the senators. I don't have a PhD. I'm nothing, but I talk common sense, and that's what I do when I talk to people.
Don Thomas, the president of AFGE's TSA Local 556. Don, great to see you again. Thanks for coming on the show.
Always a pleasure, my man.
Thank you to our guests this week, First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill, Congressman John Sarbanes, Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey, and AFGE TSA Local 556 President Don Thomas. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. WFED Washington, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas.